it's spring in Wisconsin, and that means tornado season is likely just around the corner.
The science of tornado prediction is still inexact. Tornadoes and the supercell storms that create them can pop up suddenly, and the tornadoes themselves move erratically and last for hugely different amounts of times, from minutes, sometimes even to hours.
Lee Orff is with us now. He leads a lab that's out to better understand and predict tornadoes using computer models at the Space Science and Engineering Center at UW-Madison. Lee, thanks so much for coming up to the studio today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, what are the big questions that scientists are still trying to answer about tornadoes?
Sure. So, you know, we're all familiar with run-of-the-mill thunderstorms that we see in Wisconsin. The vast majority we see last about 45 minutes and produce some rain, you know, keep the lawn green, things like that. We're not interested in those types of storms. We're looking at the storms that produce the biggest, nastiest tornadoes imaginable. And the questions that really remain are, what's going on inside those storms, right? What's going on inside the storms that produce the devastating long path, very, very, very bad tornadoes versus the storms that look very similar but don't produce those tornadoes? And that's the real question we're trying to get at here, so we can give better predictions.
Are there similar ingredients that, you know, they all come together, only sometimes you get a tornado and sometimes you don't? Do we know at least some of the fundamentals?
Yes, we do. That's a great question. So if you're looking for the ingredients for a supercell thunderstorm, which is defined as a thunderstorm with a rotating updraft that lasts a very long time, you need a few ingredients. You need what's called wind shear, which is the variation of horizontal winds with height in the atmosphere. You need instability, which is a measure of how conducive the atmosphere is to very large vertical motions, updrafts. You need moisture, humidity, and you need something to trigger the storm. When it comes to tornadic supercells, the ones that produce tornadoes, we're getting a better picture. You need some very concentrated wind shear near the ground, so you have winds varying very rapidly with height. So if you can imagine, for instance, very strong winds from the east at, say, 20 miles an hour near the ground, and maybe only a few hundred feet above that, you have winds from the southeast, and then from a few hundred feet above that, you have winds from the south. So you have this very, you know, the winds are turning with height. That seems to be a critical ingredient for getting really nasty tornadoes.
And the work you're doing, as I understand it, is pretty cutting edge in that some of this technology did not exist that long ago. So you're actually able to, in a sense, recreate a tornado on your computer screen. Can you explain a little bit how that works?
Sure. So to be clear to your listeners, I am not a field meteorologist, so I'm not chasing storms and taking data with radars and such. And that's a very important part of the whole meteorological community and the research focus. So what I'm doing, though, is I'm using supercomputers to try to simulate the atmosphere in a condition where you have these big storms. So what we do is we take the conditions that we think, a loaded atmosphere that's ready to produce a big nasty supercell, and we start the model with those conditions, clear sky, no storm yet, and then we grow a storm in that environment. So we sort of perturb the atmosphere, and a cloud will start to rise and sort of frothy and bubbly like you see in the real atmosphere, and it just grows and grows. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in these simulations. So sometimes we'll do this, you know, this very elaborate simulation, we'll get a supercell and no tornado. And then we'll do it again, and we might get a weak tornado. And then what we manage to do that's significant is we manage to get one that was very similar to a storm that happened on May 24th, 2011 in Oklahoma, which was a long path, you know, the path of the storm was, you know, 50 or 60 miles, I can't remember exactly, but it was an EF5, which is the highest category of tornado. And we managed to reproduce a storm that's a lot like that one. It has the same characteristics, namely a very wide multiple vortex tornado ends up forming. It's on the ground, well, the digital ground, for a long time. And so we've been analyzing this simulation, trying to figure out what's going on. And some features have popped out that we're looking into.
Yeah, what popped out?
Well, it turns out, at least in the simulation, I don't want to give everyone the impression we've solved the problem by any means, but there's these little, you can call them like mini tornadoes, these little spinning whirls of air that are called mesocyclones that are in abundance in the simulation. And we can highlight those and view them with model data because we can look at a field of spin. We can actually plot that field. In the atmosphere, if you don't have some dust or condensation sort of stirring up with the air, you just don't see these things. So one of the things we discovered are these little vortices spinning around that kind of merge together. And apparently, right when the tornado is forming, you have a whole bunch of these just kind of coming together to sort of get this spin really going. The other thing we discovered, we gave a name, which is always a thing you take very seriously in science. You know, you come up with a new acronym or something. We call it the streamwise vorticity current. And it's really difficult to describe this on radio. But you, if you think of a rolling pin, say, on the ground, you're making bread or something, and it's rolling horizontally. So that would be the streamwise vorticity current before it gets turned up into the updraft. So essentially, you have spin in the horizontal that gets tilted into the vertical. And that's a well-known process in meteorology when you look at this term we call vorticity, which is really a measure of spin and wind shear. And it's a really interesting organization that occurs. You have this little funny SVC thing that kind of comes up and around the tornado. It doesn't actually touch it. So anyway, that's about as much as I should probably say on the air. If you know, and I do have video online and such that people can actually see these things in action.
So is this kind of new stuff, being able actually to see what's happening with the very beginning birth moments before a tornado?
Well, again, to be clear, I'm not the first person to simulate a supercell that produces a tornado. I want to be clear about that. But what we've done, the analogy I like to use is we've gone from like a 2-megapixel camera to a 20-megapixel camera. So we've gotten a whole lot sharper picture of what's going on in three dimensions in the storm. So again, it's in science, you want to be careful. We're always building upon the accomplishments of many, many people before us. But what we've done is we've managed to get our hands around the immense size of the problem and have gotten pretty good at utilizing supercomputers and handling hundreds of terabytes of data so that it doesn't sort of just crush you with the weight of the data, which is really, I've spent more time working with data and managing large amounts of data than I actually have on meteorology. So I hope for that to change now that we've got a really good simulation and we're sort of spinning up our projects.
We're talking with Lee Orff right now, an associate scientist with the Space Science and Engineering Center at UW-Madison, and he leads a lab that works with computer modeling of tornadoes to better understand how they work and why they form. And you're very clear that you're not out in the field doing this. You're in front of your computer. And we just had a big tragedy with some storm chasers being killed. There's a crash in pursuit of a tornado. I mean, is this the future of studying tornadoes and other dangerous weather events, that we do it from a safe distance with a computer model instead of being out there on the road running after a thing like that?
I have to say, it's always going to be both. You're always going to have the observational collect data from the real atmosphere approach. And that is a valid, incredibly important approach. And in fact, it's what fuels a lot of the work we do at SSEC with satellites. We're observing storms from space. When it comes to storm chasing, usually you have to get pretty close in order to get if you're a research scientist and you have like a radar on the back of your truck, you have to get within, say, a half a mile of that storm to scan it pretty well. So we're going to keep doing that. Now, I want to be clear, there's one great exception. There was a storm in May 31st, 2013, again in Oklahoma, which actually did kill some professional storm chasers. Now, this is the first time this had ever really happened, and it was a crazy storm. It was really an anomalous storm. The tornado was 2.5 miles wide. It had tornadoes inside the tornadoes, and it was easy for someone to get lost in that. Now, that's an anomalous case. One of the issues we have today with research field studies of tornadoes is that in places that are around Oklahoma especially, a lot of amateurs will go out to chase storms, and they clog up the roadways, so the scientists can't get their radars in place. And this is actually a real problem. So, no, we're going to continue to do the field study approach and the observational approach. But my approach, the computer approach, is equally important in meteorology, and you'll see this in meteorology a lot. You have the theoretical modeling approach and then the observational approach, and these two approaches complement each other wonderfully. If you see something in a model and you can't find it in the atmosphere, well, you better go find it or it's probably not there. But on the flip side of that, if you identify a feature in observed data and you can't explain it theoretically, that's also a problem.
Okay, so looking at the real life ramifications of your research, and a big one is to predict that there's a tornado that's about to happen and to warn people with the right interval of time. Too far ahead, it sounds like, they're going to ignore it, too late, and they can't scramble to safety in time. So what kind of applications are you looking for here?
Yeah, that's a huge, very good point. And in fact, a lot of research in meteorology today is being done in collaboration with sociologists, because we have to understand how people respond to things. And I always like to joke that if you think predicting the weather is hard, try predicting human activity, right? So as far as the final goal of this research is indeed to produce better forecasts, more timely forecasts, more targeted forecasts. So instead of giving a tornado watch over a county area or something like half the size of a county, we'll be able to shrink it down to a much smaller region so that people only in the path of the tornado that hasn't formed yet can be evacuated or can go to their safe space. As far as what to do if a warning occurs, like you said, if you give people too much time, they may do things that will ultimately come back to bite them. Like, oh, I'm going to go pick up my kids at school because that's, you know, very important to me. Well, what if you get stuck in traffic? And there have been very close calls with high-end tornadoes where people are stuck in the highway trying to escape, and then it's just a big traffic jam. So there's a multiple facets to this work. It's not just the scientific aspect, but also the aspect of how humans react to data when they get it and information when they get it.
Now I want to ask you, as we start to wrap up, I understand this is something's a little personal to you, kind of a lifetime calling. You witnessed a deadly tornado. We're pretty darn close to one when you were a child. Can you tell us what happened briefly?
Well, the story I always tell my students when I was teaching, two things happened. When I was like 6 or 7 years old, my house got hit by lightning, and I saw the wires glowing and the paneling blown across and the insulation. It really was scary. A couple of years later, this would have been October 3rd, 1979, I had lived in far southern Massachusetts in a town called Feeding Hills, and a tornado, a very anomalous storm. It was an F4. It went up the Connecticut River Valley through Bradley International Airport, destroyed a bunch of antique aircraft, and it's still one of the most expensive tornadoes to date. And it killed some people and destroyed a lot of property. And that tornado essentially dissipated very close to my house. Our house got some winds that were damaging. They were not tornadic winds. They were straight line winds, knocked some trees down. But that was another huge event. So I guess I was called to do this. But to be quite honest, I just love science, all science. Weather works good for me.
Mm. So interesting, Lee. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing today.
And thanks for having me.
That was Lee Orff, an associate scientist with the Space Science and Engineering Center at UW-Madison. He leads a lab that works with computer modeling of tornadoes to help better understand how tornadoes work and why tornadoes form.
Coming up, we'll talk about the decision in Congress to roll back an FCC rule that would protect your internet browsing habits. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.